All right, good evening and welcome to the Allegiance Team Academy regular meeting of the Board of Directors, February 25th, 2018. The meeting's called to order at 7:02 p.m. The meeting location's at 13050 2nd Street, Chino, California, 91710. The agenda, instructions for presentations to the board by parents and citizens. Allegiance Team Academy, Allegiance, which operates Allegiance Team Academy Thrive Charter School, welcomes your participation at the Allegiance Board meetings. The purpose of a public meeting of the Board of Directors is to conduct the affairs of Allegiance in public. We are pleased that you are in attendance and hope that you will visit these meetings often. Your participation assures us of continuing community interest in our school. To assist you in the ease of speaking, participating in our meetings, the following guidelines are provided and are included in the board policy. Agendas are available to all audience members. There's some on that back table, or you can find it online. Note that the order of business on this agenda may be changed without prior notice. For more information on this agenda, please contact Allegiance at email@allegiancesteamacademy.org. Requests to speak forms are available to all audience members who wish to speak on any agenda items or under the general category of public comments. Public comments are set aside for members of the audience to comment. However, due to public meeting laws, the board can only listen to your issue, not take action. The public is invited to address the board regarding items listed on the agenda. Comments on an agenda item will be accepted during consideration of that item or prior to consideration of the item in the case of a closed session item. Please turn in comment cards to the board secretary prior to the item you wish to speak on. These presentations are limited to 3 minutes and total time allotted to non-agenda items will not exceed 15 minutes. When addressing the board, speakers are requested to state their name and adhere to the time limit set forth. In compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act and upon request, Allegiance Team Academy may furnish reasonable auxiliary aids and services to qualified individuals with disabilities. Individuals who require appropriate alternative modification of the agenda in order to participate in board meetings are invited to contact Allegiance Team Academy. Roll call. Ms. Odo?
Here.
Ms. Rawl?
Here.
Ms. Choi?
Here.
Ms. Okamoto?
Here.
And Mr. Bressi, I'm here. Public comments, items not on the agenda. No individual presentation shall be for more than 3 minutes, and the total time for this purpose shall not exceed 15 minutes. Ordinarily, board members will not respond to presentations and no action can be taken. However, the board may give direction to staff following a presentation. Are there any comment cards? All right, no comment cards. Approval of the agenda for the board meeting for February 25th, 2018. It is recommended the Board of Directors approve the agenda for the regular board meeting for February 25th, 2018. Do I have a motion?
I'll make a motion.
Second?
Okay.
Second by Vanessa. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes 5-0. Communications, comments from Board of Directors. Ms. Choi, do you have anything? Ms. Rawl?
No.
Ms. Okamoto?
No.
Ms. Odo?
I don't have anything.
And I have nothing either. CEO's report. You're up.
It'll reach.
No, it'll reach you from here.
It will?
Yeah.
Good evening. See you all. I'll keep it short and sweet. We've got a tight agenda, so just some updates for you. Since we last chatted a week ago. Lottery application and enrollment front. March 2nd, we're scheduled to have the lottery application process go live. Laura and I were working on it. Now we brought in Diana to support and to ensure that the system, the online system school, is built to our charter's lottery preferences. We're test driving it now, and it looks like it's on schedule for the 2nd. And we'll make sure that all the notifications and on social media and so on, and the website, etc., are making the lottery application accessible to all. So it's got language settings, so you can apply in different languages. It's built again to our lottery specifications. And again, the test drive is going to take place this week, and we're ready to go live at the end of the week. So excited, a lot of excitement about that, for sure. On the human resource side, I'm proud to introduce to everyone Callie Moreno, who I endorse strongly for the director of education programs. Callie's background on all things curriculum instruction, interventions, and it makes her a perfect candidate for Allegiance at this time in this role. We worked together for several years and taking on several initiatives that we were able to bring to our schools. So I look forward to where we get to go from here. It's going to be an exciting new chapter. She's already dug in and back to another community and grilled me with a lot of questions about Allegiance in Chino and so on. I think you're going to be as thrilled as I am to have her come on. And our candidate for Director of Business Services couldn't make it tonight. She tried to make her schedule work. But we're also really excited to introduce Meredith King as the founding Director of Business Services. And if you had a chance to look at her resume, it kind of speaks for herself. But she's helped in the last 11 years keep our current employer, Avison's, finances sound. So Avison's been able to realize over 15% that's a low-end average, sorry. It's probably closer to 18% annual reserves, and Meredith has been instrumental on that. So just some context, that the state law requires us to have a 5% reserve in our budget, right? So we're built to do that in this first year at Allegiance. With Meredith's help, we'll get to an even higher. We'll build stronger reserves. You want to have that, right, for the rainy day kind of piece? So Meredith's guidance and knowledge is going to help that. She brings far more expertise to on the human resource side. She understands, as an MBA, right? So a lot of her skill set's going to show immediately. So she'll join us shortly in one of the future board meetings. I was able to meet with Chino Valley's superintendent and deputy superintendent this last week. We got together for about half an hour. We had not met before, right? We kind of heard about one another in the last few months, but we hadn't met. So it was a great opportunity to get together. And I made my kind of vision, not just for Allegiance, but for the relationship with Chino Valley clear. It's ambitious, but it is what it is. I said I really want us to, I asked them to think about what the relationship beyond an MOU and a Prop 39, property agreement could look like, where both parties aren't really operating, sort of an island unto themselves, but are really in a collaborating. So we threw out some ideas around professional development and school visits and so on as a way to kind of build a relationship that is not the most common between charters and their authorizers, but both of us were really interested in that. So I think it was a really good start to kind of set the tone around what Allegiance will be in the larger community, specific in this case to Chino Valley, to the authorizer. So with that, we are, if you're not aware, we have an MOU with the district that also specifies some timelines, some policies that we need to get approved and so on. It's been, the MOU that gives us timelines has been great guidance, because it keeps us sort of on pace for where we need to be on our timeline to have everything ready for the school opening. So, in many respects, we're ahead of schedule on some of the policies. On our staffing, we held a full day of interviews last week for teacher candidates and walked away with excited about several candidates. So we'll be following up with some of them. We'll also be scheduling another follow-up, sort of a job fair-like day. So we'll have a different format to the follow-up interviews that we're going to schedule in the coming weeks. And that will put us in a pretty healthy place as far as staffing goes. This is the time, especially for teachers, right, to find them. They'll start making decisions about what they'll do next year. So the ones that we're interested in, we're already in contact with them, and hopefully, kind of starting to put that team in place. As team members come on, Callie's been pushing me, rightfully so, to make sure that team is instrumental in a lot of the decisions that have to be made, right? Curriculum and schedule, bell schedule, trips that students go on, the list goes on, right? Things we want to realize. And she's been pushing for me to make sure that they have a voice and are part of that conversation. So that, I believe, is my report. Are there any other questions?
Nope. All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Next up, item scheduled for presentation, charter school governance training. And we have Ms. Greta Proctor from Procopio here to give us this awesome training. It's going to be on the Ralph M. Brown Act, the Public Records Act, avoiding conflicts of interest, board member roles and fiduciary duties, and best practices.
Just a few things.
Yeah.
So I have a couple extra copies if anyone wants to follow along. Where is the easiest spot to pop from here? Is that okay? Or?
Wherever you want to go.
Okay. I'm going to try to stay on time because this can get pretty long. So my name is Greta. I'm an education attorney. I represent lots of charter schools, also school districts. I'm really excited to work with you guys. This is very, very impressive to have this up and running like this before school has even opened and money has started flowing. So really, kudos to all of you. I'm just going to dig in. If you have questions as we go along, please just ask. Chime in and interrupt me because this should be more of a conversation. The goal is that you guys take away what you need to be able to do effective board meetings, comply with the Brown Act, Public Records Act, conflicts of interest rules. There's a lot that you have to abide by as board members and staff. And anyone with questions in the audience, please just chime in. So we're going to cover roles and responsibilities, how to run meetings under the Brown Act, what it means to have public records, your school's records being public records, board member duties, which are generally the duty of care, financial oversight, and loyalty, how to avoid conflicts of interest, and then some best practices. So in terms of organizational structure, Allegiance Steam Academy is a California nonprofit public benefit corporation that is tax exempt as a 501c3. That entity is what operates the independent charter school for which you've applied for a charter and it's been approved. So the board of directors of the nonprofit corporation is you all, and you are responsible for anything the nonprofit does. And this nonprofit does a charter school. So you're ultimately responsible for the outcomes of the charter school. Your directors are elected in accordance with your bylaws and your charter. You do have, your authorizer does have the authority to put a representative on your board. Pay attention to what your charter and your bylaws say about how board members get elected, because you all actually have some kind of complicated procedures, which is intended to get you really good directors, but it means that you can't just quickly add someone onto your board. There's kind of a whole process to go through, which you already know about.
Yes.
Overall, the board of directors' role is to ensure the long-term viability of this organization. So you guide the mission and the vision of the charter school. You monitor the school performance, both financially, in terms of academic outcomes, enrollment, all those things. You are the accountability factor. You're the oversight, the leadership. And you hire and you decide the compensation of and you evaluate your executive director, who's responsible for the day-to-day actual operations of the school. So you're not expected to know how to run a school on a day-to-day basis, but you are expected to provide general oversight and leadership. And each one of you brings to this role different backgrounds. You know, if I was sitting on a board, I would bring a legal background, but I have no background in actually being a teacher in a classroom. So you all bring to the table whatever your specific background is. And the goal is that you have enough folks on your board that make up a diverse, you know, grounded group that you can have someone who knows what it means to do fundraising, someone who knows what it means to oversee finances, someone who knows what it means to be part of the community, all that stuff. So on slide 6, this is kind of a good starting point for what do you do. The board needs to approve the major educational and operational policies of the school. This definitely includes the things that are listed here, and it's also going to include some of the things that are not listed here. So you have a very robust MOU, much more lengthy than most charter schools' MOUs. You also have some conditions of approval that went into place when your charter was approved. Your charter itself is very long and extensive. Get to know those documents, because those spell out exactly what you do and what your leader does and what everybody, how everybody's role works together. So I have in here as the last bullet point, others, and that's kind of so that you keep in mind, well, there may be things and policies that I need to approve that aren't necessarily on this list. This is the general list that all charter school boards do. You're going to have a lot more. One example of that is that I know your authorizer required you to adopt the FICMAT accounting manual for charter schools as your accounting manual. That's very unusual, and FICMAT's accounting manual has a whole list of policies that many charter schools don't have, like a nepotism policy. So you know you need a nepotism policy because it's in that manual, whereas most charters don't need it. So it's kind of getting familiar with the documents that govern you so that you can know what you're required to approve. Doesn't mean you have to go draft the nepotism policy. policy. That would be for your staff to do. But if you haven't seen it come up on the agenda, you know, have a little kind of checklist going for what you guys need to do. As school starts, you'll get more of a feel for this slide 7. What are you going to be approving on a regular basis? It's going to be major contracts. You probably already approved your interim executive director contract, or however you phrase that. Any leases for property, property unused agreement, or a loan, those kinds of things need to be coming to the board, and that's going to be on a regular basis. You also always are going to be approving the budget, the interim reports, which is a way for you to see how the budget is stacking up to what you're actually doing. You're going to approve the financial report at the end of the year, which shows how you did for the full year. Any budget revisions that come through mid-year are going to come to you. And the annual audit, which is kind of an oversight, an external third party coming in and checking and making sure that your internal controls are what they should be. On the educational side, but also related to the budget, you're going to approve the LCAP, which is the Local Control Accountability Plan. That's the state's way of saying, how are you spending your funds in a way that aligns with the mission of your school. Every year you have to update that. Your staff is going to do the legwork and bring it to you, and you're going to be able to contribute and ultimately approve that. I can't stress enough that a lot of this is approving and monitoring the financial policies and procedures. You don't have to have a background in finance, but ask questions so that when you see an interim report, you know what you're looking at. You know, the most simple way to think about it is the budget is a blueprint for the full year. You approve that because someone's telling you, one of your consultants, maybe it's your executive director in your back office, are telling you this is what we need to allocate here, there, and everywhere else. So you approve that, relying on their good judgment, and then you keep an eye on it throughout the year. That's your role. Are we way overspending in one category? If so, does it make sense? Do we need to reallocate? That kind of stuff. So you don't have to have a background in finance, but you need to understand generally what's happening with the school's funds. And the reason I stress this now as opposed to presentations 3 years ago is because there's much more scrutiny on board members having that role right now. Slide 8 is kind of comparing your role to the role of your leader. Fiduciary oversight, what you do, the CEO or executive director, whatever you call that person, they do the day-to-day operations. I can't stress enough, don't try to get involved in the day-to-day operations. Right now you're in kind of a weird situation where you aren't fully staffed up, so you're probably having to do a lot more than you will. But once school is up and running, do not try to supervise teachers. Do not try to discipline teachers. That's really the role of the staff that you hire, and you delegate that responsibility to them. And this becomes important because your D&O policies, your insurance, that is, and your statutory indemnity, that doesn't protect you when you try to get your hand involved in day-to-day operations. So don't be too eager as a board member. The board, really, your job is to supervise the top one and sometimes two employees, depending on if you have an in-house CFO. But really, you delegate most of this to your executive director and then supervise that person. I wanted to quickly cover the role of the board chair, secretary, and treasurer. The board chair presides at board meetings. Usually this person has you're all volunteers and you all contribute a lot of time. Usually the board chair puts on a lot more time than the other board members. At a meeting, this is generally just guiding the board through each decision and through the agenda, generally weighing in on matters of procedure. If you've got members of the public who want to speak, you're calling them and you're counting, you know, stopping them at 3 minutes or whatever your policy is. But really, as a board chair, as you know, it's going to be a lot of being the point of contact. Yep. And, you know, kind of shepherding all the other people. And you might have other duties that are assigned by the board to head up a committee or the like, but really it's like being point of contact and face for the school. The secretary has a big job, too. This doesn't have to be a board member. It probably is right now, but ultimately you'll have a secretary who's a staff person, preparing agendas and minutes, keeping your corporate records, providing notice of meetings, which can be a little onerous under the Brown Act, or, you know, making sure things are posted within the right deadlines. And under your charter, that secretary is going to be a liaison to the district in issues that are related to policy and records, which could be a lot. So sometimes districts request a lot of stuff, and that would go through the secretary. The treasurer is the person who's overseeing the books of the school. So the accounting side, business transactions, annual audit, doesn't mean that your treasurer has to be your CFO. Oftentimes the CFO job is outsourced to like Charter Impact or CSMC, one of those shops. But the treasurer provides kind of an internal oversight of that. Any questions about roles? I sort of breezed through that. Okay, let's get into the Brown Act. You're already following the Brown Act, so that's great. I'm just going to jump right into where can you have meetings, how often can you have meetings, specifics. Under your charter, you can have meetings anywhere in the boundaries of the district. Usually that's going to be at your school site once you get your Prop 39 sorted out. Your bylaws don't require you to have monthly meetings, but I believe your MOU or your conditions, I saw somewhere that
it's in our MOU once a month.
Okay, so monthly meetings is going to be your regular schedule. Did you guys already approve a calendar for when?
Yeah, up until the end of this fiscal year.
Perfect, yeah. So once a year you approve a calendar for regular meetings. Try to stick to it. Not everybody can come to every meeting, but try to make it at a time where you can, where you're not canceling regular meetings all the time. You can have special meetings in the meantime, but try to stick to those regulars. What is a meeting? So this sounds easy, but it's not. Anytime a majority of you all get together to talk about the school, you're having a meeting. Even if you're not making a decision, even if there's no agenda, it could happen in a social setting where you have, you all show up for the lottery and you start talking about, well, what should we do next year. Be careful of that, because anytime there's a majority of you, you're having a meeting. And under the Brown Act, in order to have a meeting, you have to notify the public so that they can attend and participate and weigh in on what you're talking about. So be really careful about inadvertent meetings. Another way that this happens a lot is through emails or text messages. So serial meetings is where, person one will text person two, who then texts person three, or reply all on emails. Just never hit reply all with your fellow board members. So when there's a five-member board, any two of you can talk about an issue, but the minute that you loop in that third person, you've now created an inadvertent meeting. So be careful about that. The reason that it's so important is because the goal of all of these sunshine laws, the Public Records Act and the Brown Act, is that the business of this public school should be conducted in public. And so anytime you have these inadvertent serial meetings or these inadvertent meetings where there's no agenda, you're conducting school business behind closed doors. And it just, in addition to being contrary to policy, it really looks bad to your authorizer. Any questions about serial meetings? Let me make a quick,
I have one. So exactly, say for instance at the lottery and we're all there.
Yeah.
We can't talk to one another, or exactly what can we say or not say? So we look like we're having a meeting type thing?
Yeah, so this happens at something like a lottery or a graduation where you all want to be there. You can say, I love that kid's up there, or my kid did this. That kind of thing is not the business of this board. But whenever you guys start talking about anything that's the business of this board, like, hey, this lottery procedure that our charter has should be changed next year to do XYZ, or any of that is when you're having an inadvertent meeting. And sometimes you just want to be careful about perception. If you're all five there, don't huddle together at a table and talk, because it's going to look like maybe you're having a meeting. So just kind of stick to groups of two, be cognizant of it.
And the events that kind of stand out for me are like the fundraising events and social dinner, right?
Yep. That's when you graduations, things
right.
like that.
Turn around, all of a sudden, three of you sitting at the same table, right?
Yeah.
That's probably something to look out for.
Yep, be careful about that. I was going to say something about emails. Oh, okay, so there's a distinction between information-only emails, and those are okay. So someone like your staff may be shooting you an email every Friday or every month or whatever it is, or your attorney sometimes sends you an email. That goes out to everybody, giving you all the same information at the same time. That's okay, and that's not a violation. But the minute that you guys all start replying all, or three of you are talking about that email, that's when the meeting happens. So don't be alarmed if you all get the same email from your staff. That's okay. It's just that if one of you were to do that, it would be a violation. Does that make sense? You don't have committees yet, probably. But later on down the road, keep in mind that the Brown Act applies the same way it does to you all, to any standing committees that you have. If you have a governance committee, a finance committee, if it's a standing committee, the Brown Act applies. There are times when you have ad hoc committees, like an ad hoc committee that only exists for a short period of time to help recruit an executive director or something like that. Brown Act doesn't apply to that kind of mechanism, but it does to any standing committee. Working groups that you might set up with your staff, Brown Act doesn't apply. Parent site councils, stuff like that, Brown Act doesn't apply. Two types of meetings, regular meetings. These are the ones that are according to your calendar that you approve. Those require 72 hours of posting of notice. And the reason that's important is because you can only talk about things that are on the agenda. So if you're at a regular meeting, all the things that you're going to talk about should have been posted 72 hours in advance, so that people have time to come and weigh in. know, they read the agenda and say, oh, that's on there, I gotta take off work and make a point to be at this meeting. Special meetings occur anytime between regular meetings when you need them. They're kind of issue-based. Those only require 24 hours posting of notice. And I put it on here, but I never talk about emergency meetings because it's very, very rare. This is a serious emergency, and you'd be calling your lawyer if something like that happened.
I have a question. Like for the special meetings, mm-hmm. just because the way we have that MOU is set up with the policy dates that are, a guideline, but should the policies be on regular board meetings or on special?
It doesn't matter. The intention of special is just to do stuff that you weren't able to plan ahead for, so it's best if you're doing your policies at regular meetings, but it's not required. And with so much that you guys have to do, I wouldn't try to be doing them all at regular. If you can, wonderful. That's a lot on your plate to try to get all that ready for the regular meeting. So it's okay to have special meetings. And it's okay to have a special meeting when one of you can't come. It's best if you're all here, but you're volunteers.
And CVUSD, they've been working with us knowing, because they know that these dates are
tough
to meet, and we can't, like our special ed policy, we can't get that approved because we're not part of a SELPA yet. So they're understanding that the timeline that was set is probably not 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and hopefully they'll understand that once you do join a SELPA, you might need to schedule a special meeting to adopt that between regular meetings. Yeah. But the worst thing really is when boards don't stick to their schedule for regulars, and then they just have a bunch of specials to make up for it. Because you're not really giving the public the notice you should when you're doing that. Just try to stick to your regulars. If you need to have specials, that's okay too. Districts do that too. Slide 17 is pretty important. Flag that for later because there's going to be times when you guys need to teleconference. If you're a board member and you can't find childcare or you just for some reason can't make it to a board meeting, think about teleconferencing in so that you can still participate and especially just listen to what's going on. But be careful to follow all the rules for teleconferencing. So these are all the rules for teleconferencing. They're very archaic. That's why I say flag it, because it wouldn't be intuitive. The agenda has to identify the teleconference location. So if I'm planning to call in from home at next Thursday's meeting, I would put my home address on the agenda. I would also have to post the agenda at my home, either 24 or 72 hours in advance on my front door, which sounds a little weird. I would have to open my home up to members of the public who wanted to come participate from there. Literally invite them into my living room to sit there while I'm on the board meeting call. It very rarely happens, but you have to do that. Anytime you have a board member on teleconference, all votes should be taken by roll call. Do you call for votes? Right now, probably, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes the secretary does it, but...
Right now
you're calling.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I say get in the habit of calling for it by name. Okay. Right now it's okay to say all in favor and everybody says aye. And then the secretary can write down who everybody is. But really, your minutes need to reflect how each person voted. If anyone's on teleconference, you got to be doing it by name. So it's good to just get in the habit of running through the names each time. Right. And then this quorum thing. If you're traveling in New York for work or something and you want to dial into a board meeting, that's fine. And you can do the posting of the address and all that. But be aware that unless you're within the jurisdiction, the district may say, well, you shouldn't be participating as a board member. I say still try to call in. Have the discussion, have your comments be reflected in the minutes, but be aware that a quorum of the board, the decision makers, needs to be in the jurisdiction. Any questions about a teleconference?
And you can't vote, right, if you're teleconferencing?
You can if you're in the jurisdiction. If you're somewhere like New York, not in Chino, kind of questionable. Safest route is no.
Okay.
I already mentioned that you can only consider things at a meeting if it's on the posted agenda. And people are always saying, well, we forgot to put something on there, so let's add it. It's really hard to add something to the agenda once it's posted. And the reason is because it all goes back to this policy you needed to tell the public you're going to talk about it, because how do they know if they want to come? So I put the ways that you can add things on the agenda here, but it's rare. It's really rare. The time this comes up is when, the only time it really comes up is when there's a decision that needs to be made that you couldn't have known about when you posted the agenda, and you need to make it right now. And usually that's in the context of litigation. You have some sort of settlement offer that came in, and you have 24 hours to decide, and you already posted your agenda 2 days ago. So it's really rare. The best thing to do, do you prepare the agendas, or you do right now?
Join effort.
Okay, so the best thing to do is if you've got a regular meeting and you forgot to put something on, but you still want to put it on, just double notice it as a special and a regular. So you've got another agenda gets posted for a special meeting with that one item, and you only need 24 hours for that one. And you just hold them concurrent. You know, you run through the special real quick, and then you close the special and open the regular, and it's like you had two meetings. You did as much as you could on the regular agenda, but you got this one thing on the special. And that's perfectly fine. School districts do that all the time, too. That's slide 19. What should go on the agenda? Keep it brief. I've seen charter schools have too much on their agenda. You know the ones I'm talking about?
Yep.
Under 20 words, you don't need to write a whole paragraph for each item. Only makes your job harder. But it should be enough detail on the agenda that someone knows what you're talking about. They don't have to know all the ins and outs, but they know whether they want to come talk about it too. Post it in a publicly accessible place. Your charter says it's going to be the main entrance of the school. Definitely do not forget about posting it on the website. That's in the Bremnack now. Also in your charter and MOU. Consider whether you want to have a consent agenda if you have these really long agendas where you've got a lot to do and you don't want to call for a vote on every item. Sometimes there will be a consent agenda that includes a bunch of policies. Directors can always, at the beginning, when you approve the agenda, you can always pull something off consent. If you see the list of consent and you say, you know what, I actually want us to have a discussion about this one because I've got something to say. Then at the time when you go through the approval of the agenda, say, I'd like to pull item 3.1 off of consent. The chair would say, okay, can I get an approval of the agenda with 3.1 pulled off? Then you go through it just individually. But if you have these marathon board meetings, that's one way to kind of help. I haven't taken a close look at your agenda, but I recommend doing most of your items as information and or action because it gives you flexibility. So things like my training right now, obviously this is an information only thing, but when you put too much on your information only or report only section of your agenda, you're hamstringing yourselves. If you put it under a general agenda heading that says information and or action, then that means that at the end of the report on XYZ, you guys can weigh in and say, hey, based on what we just heard, we want to direct you to do this, that, or the other. So to create flexibility, just have it be one general action and or discussion, information and or action. Closed session, this is a limited, I brought a couple cheat sheets, really only three, one for your, you can have one board chair, maybe the secretary. This is a list of all the reasons that a board can go into closed session and how to agendize it. And if it's not on here, you can't do it. There are very few things that can happen in closed session. Talking about litigation, talking about your performance evaluation for your executive director, these are proper things in closed session. Some real estate things. But if it's not on this cheat sheet, don't do it in closed session. Most of your business should happen in open session. That's the default, so that the members of the public can be here for it. People always want to do things like uncomfortable budget discussions in closed session because you don't talk about laying people off. You got to do it in open. You don't want to say names of employees, but if you guys are having financial problems, that's really mostly got to happen in open session. So even if it's uncomfortable, usually it's going to happen in open. Quick note about closed session. Please take it seriously. If you are in closed session, you cannot leak what is happening in closed session. Really, this includes like your wife and your family members and your kids. You know, if it's happening in closed session with the board and maybe your lawyer or your executive director, it's really got to stay in that small group. That's the purpose of the closed session. So be careful about that. You can actually get in trouble for violating that. Members of the public have the right to speak at any board meeting before action is taken on any item. Usually you have a public comment section where you call for public comments at one time, or you can decide to do it by agenda item, whatever you prefer. People don't have to sign in. It's okay to have a sign-in sheet. It might be a good idea, but keep in mind someone does not have to sign in. You as board members can, you know, people may comment, may criticize you, may criticize the school. Board meetings can get kind of heated. There's a limit. You know, you don't have to take personal criticism, but if someone is criticizing the program in the school, try to view that as something you want to hear. They have the right to say that just as much as anyone else has the right to, you know, praise the school. Everybody's public comment should be time limited. Usually it's 3 minutes or sometimes 1 minute. Stick to that. Don't give the folks who are doing positive things more time than the ones who are saying negative things. So be consistent. And that's really the chair's job, to keep an eye on all this. A lot of times chairs say, oh, we don't need to limit public comment to 3 minutes because fairly very few people show up. Just do it, because sometime you're going to have 50 parents show up and want to speak, and you should really put time limits on it. And you don't want to have to say, well, we're putting time limits on it now, but we never did it in the past. Just be consistent. School districts are usually very rigorous about this, and you guys should be too. Quick distinction between a regular meeting and a special meeting. At a regular meeting, members of the public can comment on anything in the school's jurisdiction. Like anything that you as a board would normally talk about, I can make a comment on it even if it's not on the agenda. At a special meeting, you're there just to talk about the issues on the special meeting agenda. So you don't have to hear general public comment at a special meeting. The goal is that a special meeting is a little more in and out than a regular meeting. And so if you decide this is allowable under the Brown Act, if you decide to do it, I would just say that at special meetings, when you call for public comment, just call for it on agenda items.
The couple special meetings we've had, I've just left for public comments, not on the agenda.
Yeah, and that's okay to do that, but there will come a time where you might want to breeze through your special meeting agenda and you've got 10 people who want to talk about something else. That's not the time to start enforcing the rule.
Yeah.
So I would say be consistent about it. If you're having your monthly meeting, then that should be enough time for people who want to comment on things that you're not talking about on the agenda. Keep in mind that public comment includes employees, so you may have teachers who want to talk. Same rules apply to them. Board meeting minutes, who's keeping minutes right now? Because you're kind of in a, are you doing minutes right now?
Yeah, one of the other petitioners, she's been doing it. They just haven't come tonight.
Okay, so minutes are kind of a chore. It's actually hard to be on the board and also take minutes because you're trying to participate and keep a record of what's happening. People always ask, how much detail should I put in the minutes? Think of it as your best institutional knowledge. You know, a year down the road, when maybe you guys aren't here or you're not here, and someone comes in and tries to say, well, when they talked about the nepotism policy, did they think about this or that? Your minutes should spell that out. So you don't need it to be verbatim, everything that happened and everything that was said, but it should definitely spot all of the issues so that later on there's some memory there. I see a lot of action style minutes, which are perfectly legal. All they reflect is how people voted. But it's problematic when you try to dig in and say, well, did the board ever think about this? So to protect yourselves better down the road, when those minutes come your way and you review them before you approve them, just take a quick look that it includes the things you said that mattered. You know, I encourage you as board members to, when you look at the minutes, say, I'll vote to approve these, but I want to reflect that I did ask some questions about how the interim synced up on this line item. You know, take your own notes and make sure those are in there. Any questions about Brown Act? That's kind of a lot of evidence. Okay, so Public Records Act, I'm going to be very brief here. This is another sunshine law. This is about conducting the public's business and taxpayer dollars in the public eye. So the same way that your meetings are held in the public, your records are for the most part public. What is a record? It can include everything from documents, that you might, you know, policies and things that you might naturally think are records, to things that you might not think are records, like text messages and emails. So be aware when you're putting things in writing, even if it's your own notes, the default is usually that those are public. There are lots of exceptions. I can cover a few of them, but the default is that most of the records of the school are going to be public. Some of the exemptions are things like identifiable student records. Of course, those are not public. Personnel files are not public. Attorney-client communications are not public. Those kinds of things. But generally, the default is that most, even your text messages to each other or emails to each other, are generally going to be public. Do you have your school emails set up yet? I think you said
we do.
Right? Good. Try to conduct all your school business on school emails, not personal. Because you don't want there to be a situation where someone in the public says, hey, I happen to know that your board chair conducted a lot of business on his Gmail account, so I want to search through that Gmail account and pull everything related to the school. You just don't want to be in that position. Same with your cell phones. You know, if you're texting about school stuff, it's okay, but be aware that those texts are probably public records. So keep what you're doing on text limited, would be my advice. There was a case that came out last year that said that a public official's personal email accounts were disclosable to the extent they were conducting public business on the personal email account. So that's why I try to stress this now. Who can make a public records request? Anybody. How are they made? Usually by email or sometimes phone calls, in which case I usually say, well, encourage putting this into writing so that we know what we're looking for. But really, it's very broad. Can you charge for responding to a public records request? Not really. You can charge for copies if the person wants physical copies, but these days most people are asking for electronic records. If you have them electronically, you've got to produce them electronically, so copy costs are sort of moot at this point. You can't charge for the staff time that it takes to hunt all these records down and produce them, and trust me, it's a lot of time that it takes. You've got to respond within 10 days, but you know the law is reasonable. They know you're not going to necessarily be able to assemble stuff in 10 days, so you need to respond within 10 days, but you don't necessarily need to produce all the stuff within 10 days. And I'm telling this to you right now because you're sort of the heart of the school at this point, but ultimately this falls to staff. If I was a board member on a charter school board and I received a public records request, I would immediately forward it to my staff and ask them to follow up. Moving on to what your duties are as board members, you'll probably frequently hear your authorizers or the legislature, if they're talking about charter schools, refer to this as your fiduciary duties. So what is a fiduciary duty? A fiduciary relationship is created anytime one of the parties has a duty to act with the ultimate good faith of the other. So you are board members who have a fiduciary duty to this organization and to this charter school to act in its best interest, not your own. You know, when you're sitting here, you have your board member hat on. You may also be a parent. You may also be a community member. But when you sit on this board, you're acting for the good of the whole school, not your individual child, not your individual community, that kind of stuff. Three duties: duty of care, financial oversight, and loyalty. And I'll talk more about each of these. So the duty of care is the most obvious one. Well, actually, let me talk about your exposure real quick. I always try to put this in here so that you know what you're getting into as a volunteer board member. You don't get paid for this job, and it takes a lot of time. So there are broad indemnities and protections for you under both the law and under your D&O insurance policy. You probably don't have insurance set up yet.
We do.
You do.
Charter safe.
Very smart. Okay, good. So as a board member, I would say, okay, that's comforting right there. Because you're sitting on this board as a volunteer. You don't want to take on all this liability for yourself and your family, right? But it's important to know that you've got to act within the boundaries of what you're supposed to be doing in order for those protections to apply. So if you're out there managing teachers and going in and telling a teacher that they're fired, your insurance is not going to cover you for that. And neither is your statutory, the indemnity that's provided under the law. Because that only extends to what you should be doing. So stay within the scope of what you should be doing, and you've got a lot of protection from personal liability. Conflicts of interest is another area where this comes to the forefront. Because if a board member has a conflict of interest, and they're acting for their own personal benefit, their own financial benefit, they approve this lease because they're brother or sister is going to get a kickback from it, that's where you're not going to get any protection and could have personal liability too. So it's sort of intuitive, but I just wanted you to be aware. Duty of care. This is the obvious one. You've got to act with the care and the skill and the prudence that all of you have. And it is different for each person. Someone who has a background in finance is expected to show a little bit more diligence when it comes to reviewing the school's financials. And someone who has a background in the classroom is going to know better how to review policies about the curriculum and the educational program. So use whatever toolbox you come to this board with. Use that toolbox when you're performing your job duties. You have the right to rely on your experts. If your attorney is advising you of one thing, you can say, I trust this person because they've got this experience and they're advising you that this is the right thing to do. So you're not expected to be an expert in everything. Same goes for your school leader. That person comes to you and says, I think we should align our LCAP in this way because it makes sense. Ask the questions that you need to get an understanding, but you're not expected to know everything, right? I think that covers that. Be informed. How do you perform your duty of care? Be informed, stay informed, ask questions, be proactive. If something comes up on the agenda and you have no idea what it is, ask a question before you approve it. I can't stress that enough. And you can say, this might be a really dumb question, but what is a nepotism policy? And then the person who drafted the policy and is asking you to approve it is going to have to explain to you what it is, because you don't want to put your name on something that you don't know what it is. And there may be a few times where you have to say, hey, I just wasn't able to review this in time. I don't want that to stop the rest of the board from approving this. I'm just going to recuse myself. If you really can't get the info, you need to be comfortable with putting your name on it. But try to do your homework before the board meeting, at least leaf through whatever materials you've been provided. Flag some places where you have questions that you can ask during the meeting. Don't just rubber stamp. That's the general advice. You're not expected to know everything, but there's a long way between knowing everything and rubber stamping. Try to be in the middle there. And own your decision. Expect that when it comes to why did you approve this, if someone asks you why do you approve that, you got something to say. Well, because the executive director explained that it did X, Y, and Z. Be able to own every decision that you make on this board. What about financial oversight? So charter schools are in this funky place where you're sort of one foot in the business world, one foot in public school finance. Many folks in charter schools have a ton of experience in education, less experience in finance, yet there's this heightened scrutiny on the finance side, so it can feel like a lot of responsibility. Hire great consultants to help you. Make sure that your executive director is doing what you expect of them and can answer your questions. Same goes for your back office. Do you guys have a back office yet?
Charter Impact.
Awesome. So they are great. ask questions when they give their reports. They'll answer them for you. You'll get comfortable with the format that you use, but you want to have confidence in these kinds of vendors because otherwise you are having to shoulder too much responsibility. More in here about the annual budget and finances. I think I've harped on that enough. Do be aware, though, that I don't know if you guys have. Do you have a binder yet set up for board members that has all your documents in it?
Not yet.
So get that set up. It should have your articles of incorporation that formed this entity. That lays out the charitable purposes of what this corporation can do. It's going to say operate a charter school. You got to have your bylaws in there. Have your charter in there. It's really long, but leaf through it. Be comfortable with it. Your MOU, which is also really long in your case, the conditions of approval that you signed up for, and then you'll see that MOU and the conditions of approval refer to all these other documents, like the FICMAT accounting manual that I mentioned. That sucker is a beast, but download it, have it printed, so that you at least know what it is. You don't have to know everything that's in there, but if you leaf through it, you'll be able to get a little bit of context, and it'll be very valuable for you as board members to know, what is this whole body of laws and stuff that I've agreed to? Your charter school has agreed to a lot compared to a lot of charter schools. So if I were a board member, I'd just keep a binder and bring it to my board meeting so that it was kind of like my reference guide, I guess.
I actually had a file started. I took it for myself as secretary.
You got it? Nice, perfect. And soon you guys will have policies to add to that. Every time you adopt a policy, put it in there. Your financial policies and procedures is really the biggest one. You'll probably get that from Charter Impact.
Yeah, we already approved that one.
You already approved it? Okay.
Yeah.
And so that document lays out things like your executive director approves contracts under $10,000 and the board approves contracts over, or whatever the dollar number is. It's different for every school. But you guys should just be aware, hey, what kind of contracts have to come to you for approval? Contracts over $100,000 or whatever it is. You don't have to remember who does every single function on the finance side, but please try to have a general understanding of how it works. More about finances. You guys have to get an annual audit done for your charter school. The board is responsible for the contract with the annual auditor. So your financial folks will bring you a proposed contract, or maybe they'll bring you a couple different auditing firms to choose from. You're not expected to have a background in audits, but do be sure that this auditor that you're going to hire has the experience in public finance that you need. Maybe they're on a list of approved auditors for the state, for public schools. That's a good starting point. Basically, the annual audit is supposed to validate your internal controls. The auditor can't possibly be here every day, but they come in at the end and they take a sampling of everything and they say, okay, do your check signers do the right checks and balances to get checks out? How about employee reimbursements? They're doing a sample of everything, so you guys want to pick an auditor that you can rely on. And you'll have to form an audit committee who will work with that auditor. It's not a lot of work, but it's a very important task for you as board members. You'll approve the audit agreement in the spring, and then you'll approve the audit once it's done at the end of the year so that it can be sent out by the December deadline. Slide 37 is really just a list of, I get the question sometimes, where does my duty of financial oversight even come from? Well, here are some places. Your charter can be revoked if the board engages in financial mismanagement, and it's becoming a lot more common than it was. Charter schools used to have very little oversight, and when things went wrong, they just went down. But now, when things go wrong, it's like a very long, you guys have seen enough to know that it can be a very long and drawn out process. And ultimately, people say, well, where was the board? Were they asleep at the wheel on this? So, you know, I try to stress that one because it's becoming more common. But then there's also these other Ed Code provisions that say you have to have annual audits, and that say you have to have periodic financial reports. Your charter authorizer, which is GNOLA, has the authority to assess and monitor your fiscal condition, and you can bet they're going to be doing that. But that's a good thing. Use it as a tool in your toolbox. You know, this helps you in your role because you've got this extra check and balance that a lot of charter schools don't have. Like you were saying, NOU is a good guideline and kind of a map. That's a great way to look at it, because it's also a lot of junk that maybe you don't necessarily need to do, but at least it's providing you a rubric of what's expected. Duty of loyalty, this is about conflicts of interest. So your charter requires you to get annual training on the Brown Act, and it also, interestingly, requires you to get, or maybe it's the MLU, annual training on the Political Reform Act, and that's all about conflicts of interest. So you can tell that your authorizer is especially interested in you guys knowing what it means to have a conflict of interest and being aware of these rules. So for your charter school, there are sort of three levels of conflict of interest rules. The corporations code, which is what you follow because you're a nonprofit public benefit corporation. That's the least stringent set of rules for conflicts of interest. The Political Reform Act, which is kind of the middle. That law applies to every public agency, local public agency in California. And you guys are one of them for purposes of that law. And then Government Code Section 1090 is like the highest bar for conflicts of interest. Most charter schools do not comply with that law, but you are required to because of your MOU and your charter and all the history that's here. So let's start with the first bar, Corporation Code. This is all about avoiding self-dealing transactions. A self-dealing transaction is one that, even if it benefits the school, it also benefits you too. So, you know, I'm going to lease out my piece of property to the charter school, and it's going to be wonderful because they have space and then I make money. That's, you know, that's a conflict of interest right there. Under the corporations code, that can be dealt with by the board saying, yeah, but we think it's fair. So I try to spend a minute on this, but really there's a lot more higher bars that apply to you. So just know that that's out there. That's the standard under the corporations code, but let's move on to the Political Reform Act. The Political Reform Act is sort of a stricter law about making decisions in which you have a personal financial interest. So that scenario that I just went through where a board member wants to lease their own property to the charter school and they're gonna make money off of that deal because the charter school is gonna pay rent, but the charter's gonna get space, that's a decision that this decision maker is making in which they have a personal financial interest. And the Political Reform Act says you can't do that unless you disclose and you recuse from that decision. So you have to say on the record, hold on, this is something that affects my personal financial interests. I'm going to leave the room and I'm not going to have any part in this decision. That's the Political Reform Act. The other piece under the Political Reform Act, and the one that's going to come up more frequently for you guys, is Form 700s. Has anyone filled one out yet? You probably have.
Why did you?
Yeah. So every public official in California fills out a Form 700. And this is an annual disclosure of what are your personal financial interests that could overlap with the school. So you guys will need to adopt a conflict of interest code. Did you do that already?
We're at the first, we have the 45-day window.
Okay.
That's where we're in right now.
Okay. So you're going to need to fill one out soon.
Yes. March 11th is when we'll approve it at that board.
Okay. So your conflict of interest code says who fills out Form 700s. It's going to definitely be board members, but it's also going to be decision makers, and it'll list the positions of who those people are. And then it's going to tell you what you put on this Form 700, because you don't have to put all of your personal financial interests, but you do have to put personal financial interests that could overlap with the school. So let me give you an example. If my husband was a dentist, that's not something that the school really buys services from or does. I don't have to put that on my Form 700. But if my husband owns a Mifflin textbook company, and the school, maybe they don't buy those textbooks, but they sure could because they're in the business of buying textbooks, that's something I have to put on the Form 700. So it's really interests that overlap. The conflict of interest code will make it easy for you when it comes to property, because there's all kinds of interests. There's stocks, There's companies that you own. There's property that you own. When it comes to things like property, your conflict code will make it easy. It'll say if you own property within 2 miles of the school that isn't a personal residence, put it on there. Why? Because maybe the school would want to use it at some point. This is about putting out there for the public, what are your personal financial interests that could overlap with your decision making? It's not saying there is a conflict, it's just saying every year we want to know what you've got your hands in personally that could overlap with your job as a board member. Any questions about that? Form 700s are actually pretty confusing. So if you get one and you're confused, you can give me a call. When you go to fill this thing out, you're going to be like, this is 10 pages, what? But it boils down to pretty rational disclosures. So on the one hand, you do your annual disclosures under the Political Reform Act. On the other hand, under the Political Reform Act, when a conflict arises, you disclose it and you recuse yourself. Any questions about the Political Reform Act? Okay, so let's go on to the last one. Oh, a few notes about it. I already mentioned it, but your financial interests of your spouse counts. So it's not just you, it's also your spouse. Sometimes it can be your dependents, too. That comes into play sometimes when your dependents have stock. There are civil and criminal penalties for violations, so be very careful about this. And like I said before, conflicts of interest aren't covered by your insurance, so be careful about them. The last and highest bar for conflicts of interest is Government Code Section 1090. So back to that original example of I want to lease this space to the charter school that I own, and they're going to pay me rent, and they're going to use the space. That contract under Government Code Section 1090 is prohibited. So under Section 1090, disclosing your conflict and leaving the room, recusing yourself and not taking any part in it, letting everybody else decide is not enough. Because under 1090, your personal financial interest taints the rest of the board. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say it's a higher bar, because when you're in the context of a contract in which you have a personal financial interest, the board just pretty much can't enter into that contract. And be really careful about 1090, because there's potential civil and criminal violations under 1092. So, quick note about 1090, it doesn't actually apply to charter schools, and every year Governor Brown vetoes legislation put forward by the unions that would apply it to charter schools. But that's a battle that you don't have to worry about, because your charter and your MOU say you're going to comply with it. So just assume it applies. You've already agreed to comply. Slide 43, I think I went over most of this, but the distinction to keep in mind with 1090 compared to the Political Reform Act and compared to the Corporations Code, number one, it's stricter. Number two, it only comes into play with contracts. So you can think to yourself, you know, usually if I'm a board member, I'm going to use my kind of gut check as a way to monitor conflicts of interest. If something feels a little funky, call your executive director, call your attorney, say, hey, I have a weird feeling about this. Is this a conflict of interest? But in your mind, you can keep in mind that 1090 only comes into play if there's a contract in front of you, something like an employment contract or a lease, that kind of thing. So here's another example of 1090. Back in the old days of charter schools, executive directors always sat on the board because everybody thought, well, this makes sense. This person knows the most about the school. They can vote on everything. 1090 prohibits that from happening because that person has a personal financial interest in their contract, you know, their employment contract. And it used to be that that person would just say, well, I'm going to leave the room while you decide to hire me again and what you're going to pay me. No, not under 1090. Under 1090, the board cannot hire that person. So that's why you can never have compensated individuals serving on charter school boards. That's why all of you have to be volunteers. And school districts get to be paid per meeting because they have special rules that don't apply. So, Section 1090, when it applies, the person who has the financial interest can't be involved with the contract process at all. It's not just that last moment where you're going to put your stamp of approval on it. You shouldn't even be participating in any way, shape, or form in the negotiation that leads up to that kind of contract. From the moment that you sniff there could be a potential conflict, call your attorney and figure it out before you get too far down the road. And keep in mind that financial interest is broadly defined, too. So this came up, it was such a bummer one time, in the context of a board member's husband wanting to provide free pro bono legal services to the charter school, but that was a conflict of interest. Even though that person wasn't going to be paid for it, the idea of the FPBC, which is the body that enforces 1090 and Political Reform Act, said, well, that person's law firm accrues a lot of goodwill when they do good work for the community, and that kind of pro bono work is part of what they do for a living, and so that's a conflict of interest. So in that case, the charter school couldn't enter into that kind of pro bono contract, which sounded like it would be a win-win. So just be careful, because these little conflict of interest rules can sneak up on you. There are some exceptions, things like nonprofits or things that the FPVC has defined or that the government code has defined to be non-interests or remote interests. So I don't expect you all to memorize what those are. It's very tricky. But if you call your attorney when something like this comes up, they might be able to say, well, an exception applies here, and you could still go forward. I've already talked about the harsh penalties and remedies, so let's go with the best practices. Any questions about conflicts of interest, actually, before I move on?
Yeah, so would it be safe to say if we did have something, like you said, like an attorney providing free legal services, stuff like that, better for us to come to our attorney friends and talk with them?
Yeah, usually the way this works is that I'll get calls out of the blue sometimes from board members saying, hi, I'm a board member on this board, and here's what's going on. And it's just like a 5-minute phone call, and it's worth it. Or sometimes if you have someone on the board who knows the conflict of interest rules, you can talk to them first, or maybe your executive director knows the rules. But if I'm a board member, I want to run that to the ground before I go voting on anything or participating in anything, because conflicts of interest can just be such trouble, both for you personally and for the school. So real quick, while I'm on that, you know, if you violate the Political Reform Act as a board member or as a decision maker, or you violate Government Code Section 1090, the penalties under the law are on you personally. The school's going to suffer. You know, the authorizers are going to say that this is a violation of your charter, and the school's going to certainly suffer repercussions and blowback of conflicts of interest. But you personally are too, so it's all of our reason to be extra careful about it. And it's okay to ask your friend who's a lawyer, if they know 1090, hey, what do you think about this? But whatever you do, get the answer before you go forward with whatever the transaction is. Any of you parents of kids at the school are probably...
All five.
Okay. So people often ask me, well, wait a minute. So this contract is coming up where we get to decide whether we're going to build a football field, and my kid happens to be really into football. Is that a conflict of interest? This is why you want to have, if you can, have some board members who aren't parents. Technically, that is not a conflict. But you also don't want to be accused of wearing your parent hat instead of your board member hat. And if all of you happen to have kids who were into football, or most of you did, then you kind of can't all say, I'm going to step out for this one, because then you don't have enough people to make the decision. So as you get up and running, try to recruit a couple people who are willing to be volunteers who aren't parents, even though I know that it's awesome to have parents on the board, too. Okay, any other conflict of interest stuff? I'm trying to jam through this so we don't keep you here too long. Best practices, meet regularly. We already covered that. Get your governance training. Your documents, I can't remember what document it is, say every year. If you have a new board member come on in that interim period, I can't remember if you're required to have a training for them or not.
But no, it's just yearly.
Just yearly? Try and get them some free resources in the meantime. I don't know if any of you, or maybe all of you, are planning to go to the CCSA conference. Go to all those sessions. They're wonderful if you can. Even if you can't make it to sessions, try to pull handouts and download all the free stuff that you can, because the more you know, the better you're going to do at this job. We've already talked about and harped on the annual budget and the interim reports. Generally, just review the documents and ask questions. You don't have to be an expert, but get to know everything a little bit. Stay informed on the financial condition of the school overall, big picture. Recruit a diversity of expertise. So you can have some people on your board who are good at the financial side, others who are good at the politics side, and you sort of need all of that to be a really well-balanced charter school. Make sure that you have a system of evaluation in place, and this sometimes gets overlooked. It's not your job to put this into practice, but it is your job to make sure that it's happening. So your executive director should be able to report to you that they do annual evaluations, or more frequently, of all the teachers and all the directors and all these positions, and you guys need to be sure you're doing your annual evaluation of your executive director. Professional development is just really key. And stakeholder communication, too. You're going to have a parent council, like a PTO, whatever you call it. You're going to have certain site-based advisory councils that the law requires you to have. Like if you have a certain number of English learners, you're going to have an ELAC, an English Learner Committee. But you may have more committees than that. The more involved your parents are, the better. You cannot require parents to be involved. You cannot require volunteer hours. But you can do everything in your power to make sure that they can get involved and provide lots of opportunities. And the best charter schools have the most parent involvement. Know what rules apply to your school. This is kind of about keeping your binder. You don't have to know every word, but know what the general outline is. Make sure that your management is meeting your board expectations, and if they're not, voice your concerns. You don't want to say in open session that so-and-so hasn't, you know, that your executive director hasn't met, you know, this, that, or the other. But ask your board chair or your secretary to put a personnel evaluation on the agenda for the next meeting. You guys have to do an annual performance evaluation of your ED, but you can do interim ones as things come up. The best thing to do is get ahead of it so that this person can, you know, improve and make sure that they're doing and implementing all the policies that you guys put into place. Management needs to be providing complete and timely communication too. So if you feel like the regular reports are too short or too long, you want more detail about this or that, you can even chime in while the report's happening. Like, can you get back to us on that? I'm just interested to keep my finger on the pulse of what's happening on this. And then you'll take a note and next time report more or less on that. You have a really detailed report right now. I'm very impressed given you're not even up and running. So it sounds like you're on track for that. And then my contact info is on the last page. If you need me, just reach out.
Or speed dial too.
All right, any questions?
So much.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good night.
Thank you very much.
You've got a lot
Thank
more
you.
Bye, you guys.
All right. Actually, the remainder of the agenda, CVUSD has requested that we table the rest of the policies that we were going to review, discuss, and approve tonight, so that they can review them and get back to us. So we'll table them until further notice. With that said, adjournment. It is recommended the Board of Directors adjourn the regular board meeting for February 25th, 2018. Do I have a motion?
I'll make a motion.
A second?
I'll second.
We're going to take roll call by name. Ms. Okamoto? Ms. Otto?
Aye.
Ms. Rawl?
Aye.
Ms. Choi?
Aye.
And Mr. Vesti, aye. That said, board meeting is adjourned at 8:10 p.m.